Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jonathan Milley. I represent Timothy Poole in this appeal from the conviction and sentence imposed by the District Court for the District of South Carolina in the Florence Division. On August 1st, 2006, the Hiltons were killed at their estate in South Carolina.
Mr. Milling, you might want to speak more closely to the mic.
Yes, ma'am, I apologize. A state investigation ensued, and Timothy Poole was charged criminally by the state of South Carolina on November 22nd of 2006. On December the 27th of 2006, roughly 1 month later, Timothy Poole was released from custody, and the charges were dismissed because there was a lack of evidence. When this federal prosecution was initiated, some 2.5 years later, the federal prosecutors had the same problems, and those same problems pervaded throughout the trial, which lasted some 2 to 3 weeks in this case. Because the federal court didn't have the jurisdiction to prosecute a murder charge, what the prosecution in the Florence Division decided to do was pursue a 20-count indictment against Mr. Poole and against his wife, Jody Poole. Count one charged a conspiracy to commit mail and wire fraud. We've got 2 counts of wire fraud, and the remaining 17 counts are of mail fraud. The crux of the allegations that the federal government levied against Mr. and Mrs. Poole were that Mr. Poole, Tim Poole, the appellant in this case, was involved and responsible for the death of his adoptive mother, Linda Hilton, and her husband. And that thereafter, he, through the mails and through the wire, attempted to earn the proceeds of her estate and insurance proceeds. Because under South Carolina law, which has been codified in the South Carolina Code under the Slayer's Rule, he would not have been entitled to take under that estate if he was involved in the felonious and intentional killing of Ms. Poole. He was not.
Was the murder part of the mail and wire fraud conspiracy, as argued by the government?
It was. The cover-up was essentially what was argued by the government. The murder was essentially what the government argued precipitated the mail and the wire fraud, because without the murder, he would not have been eligible to recover under the estate. The conspiracy count between Mr. Timothy Poole and Jody Poole essentially was the two of them conspired and agreed following the deaths for them to effectuate the mails and the wiring instructions to be able to take under the estate. I do not believe that there was evidence submitted at the trial that Jody Poole knew beforehand whether there was going to be any type of a killing. And quite frankly, part of what we have briefed is that she did not know, there was no evidence presented that she was either involved in the killing of Mr. and Mrs. Hilton, or that she knew that her husband, Timothy Poole, had been involved in those killings. There is suspicious behavior that the government points to and pointed to at the trial and points to in their brief that she was asking the whereabouts of a pair of New Balance tennis shoes, that she was doing other things which the government felt was suspicious, that lent itself to circumstantially that she might have known that he was involved in the killing. But by the same token, it's also evidence that a wife is looking to try and exonerate her husband that she had no idea was involved in this whatsoever. Your Honors, the problem...
No idea that he was involved in the murder, or no idea he was involved in trying to obtain the funds from the estate?
She was clearly involved in his efforts to obtain money from the estate and from the insurance proceeds. I don't think that that's in doubt. Her involvement in that, however, is not illegal.
If that's the case, then she was part of the conspiracy to do mail and wire fraud. She
Well, I would respectfully disagree, because I think for her to be part of that conspiracy, she had to have known that he was not otherwise entitled to receive under the estate. And to establish that, the government would have to establish that she had knowledge that what she was doing was against the law, and that what she was doing was helping someone who was not entitled to take.
But you made the distinction, I thought, helpfully, between the murder and the cover-up. And it certainly appears that she participated in a conspiracy to conceal any involvement Poole might have had in the murder, and providing a false alibi, falsely advising a witness he wore flip-flops on the day of the murder, making statements regarding the disappearance of his shoes. And she did affirmatively mislead, did she not?
She made certain statements which can be seen one of two ways.
No, but not anymore. At one point they might have been, you could see them two ways, but at the stage of the proceeding where we are now, we draw every inference in favor of the government.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what you have to say is that it can't be seen any other way.
Yes, Your Honor. I would submit that her conduct, and I've argued this in the brief, and I certainly understand procedurally where we are and the inferences that are drawn from the evidence which was presented in the trial, and that all reasonable inferences are viewed in the light most favorable to the government. I would submit that she was doing what she was told, and that was what the evidence was presented, that she was doing what Timothy Poole instructed her to do regarding inquiring as to the whereabouts of the shoes, contacting witnesses and the like. But there was insufficient evidence. I don't believe there was any evidence which established that she knew that she was doing this because he was involved in the murder, or rather she was doing this because he was trying to exonerate himself.
And would that not facilitate the cover-up and the attempts to circumvent the constraint to the Slayer rule?
Well, if she knew that he was involved with the killing, if she thought that she was simply doing what he instructed to help exonerate himself, then there's not that requisite knowledge to establish that she had the criminal intent, knowing that he was otherwise prohibited from taking under the estate. I think that.
So you're saying that in order to prove she was part of the conspiracy, the government had to prove that she knew what the Slayer's rule was?
I think that to establish the conspiracy between Jody Poole and Timothy Poole, the government had to establish that she knew that he was not entitled to take under the estate, and that she was helping to effectuate his taking money that he was not otherwise entitled to take. If she believed that he was entitled to recovery of the money under the estate and the insurance proceeds, then I do not believe that they've established the conspiracy. But beyond that, Your Honors, I believe if we look at the evidence that the government presented in an effort to try and establish that Timothy Poole was involved in the murder, there's just a complete dearth of evidence. There is no direct evidence linking him to the murders, to the scene. To the contrary, the evidence that we normally find in murder cases, DNA evidence, fingerprint evidence, things like that, all indicated that Timothy Poole was not involved. And instead, it's the conjecture and speculation based upon a pair of New Balance shoes that at one point in time, prior to the murders, Timothy Poole owned, but a search warrant was executed the day after the bodies were found. It was not located. A .38 caliber pistol that was one of two types of weapons which were used in the, or could have been used in the murder, either a .38 caliber or a .357, was responsible for the murders. When Timothy Poole was a member of the Florence County Sheriff's Department, which he left in 2002, he did have one. The evidence clearly established that. And there were witnesses who testified that a revolver was seen in Mr. Poole's Cadillac Escalade, but not a single witness established that that was the same firearm or what caliber of firearm was used there.
And you made all those arguments were made to the jury.
I did not represent him at the trial.
Yeah, but all those arguments were made.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
But The difficulty, and maybe you could help me a little bit with this. You say that in order to prove she was part of the conspiracy, the government had to prove that she knew he was not entitled to the proceeds.
Yes, ma'am.
Help me understand why that would, why the fact that she was helping him confront a charge to that effect, why that level of specificity in the proof would be necessary.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that in its simplest form, a conspiracy is an agreement between two or more people to do something that the law prohibits. In this case, the allegations are that the conduct which the law prohibits is effectuating through the mails and through the wires that Timothy Poole received money under the estate and under the insurance proceeds when he was not otherwise entitled to do that, to so receive because of the Slayer's Rule. And so there has to be an agreement between Timothy Poole and Jody Poole to do something to effectuate that. And I would submit to Your Honor that for someone to be involved in a criminal conspiracy, they must know that the conduct that they are engaging in is against the law.
But you did concede that she was involved with efforts to obtain money from the estate.
Yes, ma'am. She was involved in that. Your Honor, I think looking at the sufficiency of the evidence, and I recognize that these same arguments were made to the jury, but we also should take a step backwards and look at the evidence which I've argued in the second part of my brief regarding the evidence which should not have been introduced during the trial, the 404B evidence regarding the affairs, the evidence of the partying, the level of detail which the prosecution elicited specific sexual acts from witnesses during the trial of the case, the conduct and the financial aspects dating way back to 2003, specific incidents regarding a Rolex and a four-wheeler in 2003 and 2004, which clearly demonized Timothy Poole, clearly jaded the jury's perception of him, and thereby made it appear to the jury that much more likely that he might have been involved with this. This evidence was not relevant. This evidence was not properly admitted, and it was clear error for the judge to have admitted it. It did nothing to advance the prosecution's case in this regard. And when we look at the evidence which was improperly admitted and the lack of evidence which was admitted to actually prove guilt, I would submit that the conviction in this case ought to be vacated. The sentencing aspects of the case I have briefed, and I see that I'm running out of time, but I'll go ahead and go through them as quickly as I can. But we've got two different aspects of it. We've got the murder cross-reference, and we've got the 400-year sentence as to whether or not that was procedurally and substantively reasonable. I submit on both counts that the district judge erred in both regards. I would submit, Your Honors, that with regards to the first-degree murder cross-reference, while it's clear that the guideline section do provide for cross-references under certain circumstances, the degree of specificity which is required to have been established by the district court in looking at 2B1.1 subsection C3, says that the conduct set forth in the count of conviction must establish an offense specifically covered by another guideline section. And as I pointed out in my brief, if we look at what the Slayer's Rule is and what first-degree murder requires, we have an element of first-degree murder of premeditation which is not covered under the Slayer's Rule, which was not required to be established, which the jury, quite frankly, didn't need to find, to be able to find Tim Poole guilty of the 20 counts of conviction. Based upon that, Your Honors, I would submit that the murder cross-reference was inappropriate. This is a situation where we've got a state case which could not be proven and was dismissed, driving a federal sentence. And I would submit to Your Honors that that's not what the purposes of sentencing are for. Beyond that, when we look at the consecutive sentences and the 400-year sentence which was imposed by the district court, Guideline Section 5G1.2 subsection D provides that consecutive sentences can be imposed when you've got these cases grouped together, but only to the extent necessary to produce a combined sentence equal to the total punishment. I would submit, Your Honors, that a 400-year sentence is greater than necessary to serve the purposes of sentencing. that is procedurally and substantively unreasonable in this situation, and we would ask that the court vacate the conviction, alternatively vacate the sentence imposed by the court.
Thank you very much.
Your argument on the conspiracy charge is to try and show an insufficiency of evidence as to Jody Poole because that goes to the marital privilege. That's your bottom line for that, correct?
And Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time, but with permission,
no,
I'd like to
respond.
I think it goes in part to that, in part, partly, Your Honor, I submit that clearly the privilege does not apply to persons who are involved in joint criminal activity. We've argued in our brief that there was no joint criminal activity, therefore the privilege does apply. We've got other conduct which was described, not conduct, but other conversations which was described by Jody Poole during the trial, which are outside of the involvement in this case, conversations regarding why he left the sheriff's department, whether or not he intended to move to Lakeside Plantation, which is where the Hiltons lived, a lot of different things like that, which I think clearly are covered regardless of whether or not she was involved in the conspiracy in this case. And so I think that it certainly aids the argument regarding the impact and the applicability of the marital privilege, but I think that there are other parts of the privilege which would even survive that.
Thank you.
Mr. Booth?
May it please the court. I would like to address the claim that was advanced by the appellant in the case in the sequence in which he's done it. He has obviously decided not to contest at this particular point the evidence linking Poole as the identity of the murderer with respect to the substantive mail and wire fraud counts. So let me go to the conspiracy. However, I'll be glad to answer any questions that you may have with respect to that. With respect to the conspiracy count, the object of the conspiracy here, and it's detailed in the indictment, is that the purpose of the conspiracy by Poole and Jody were to defraud the monies from the trusts and estates of Linda Poole and Henry Hilton. And the way and the manner and means by which they were going to do that was that Poole was going to conceal that he was ineligible to receive any of the funds from this estate because he was the murderer of Mrs. Poole and Henry Hilton, and therefore he couldn't take any money there. Now, the government specifically alleged that Jody's role in this conspiracy was rather limited. There was no allegation made that Jody knew in advance that Tim was going to kill his parents. The allegation was, as described in the manner and means part of the conspiracy, is that she would conceal his involvement in the murders of the Poole and Hilton, and the method by which she was going to do that were essentially two ways. One, at the very beginning, at Tim's direction, she provided the police with a false alibi by telling them that he had returned home on the night of the murder at 6 o'clock instead of returning home at 11 o'clock, which was obviously designed to draw attention away from him and therefore to allow him to get access to the trust accounts. The second way in which the government alleged that she did this was by trying to obstruct justice, as when, for example, the government realized that a pair of New Balance 471 shoes had been left at the crime scene and that Mia Evans had testified at trial that she had purchased a set of New Balance 471 pair of shoes for him, and the government was looking for this. She goes up to Rachel Atkinson, who, as you may recall, was the person that Tim met the day of the murder and who she had initially said saw him wearing tennis shoes. And Jody goes up to Rachel afterwards and says, well, you know, we really think that Tim was wearing flip-flops on that day. And, oh, by the way, the reason the police have not been able to recover the New Balance 471 tennis shoes is because the dogs ate them. Now, this particular statement is unusually probative for this reason. Initially, Tim had told Mia Evans that the reason that the police couldn't find the shoes or the reason the shoes had disappeared was because he had spilled gas on them and therefore he had thrown them away. But then later, he comes up with the statement that the dogs had ate them. Now, when a wife and a husband come up with identical statements to account for the disappearance of a valuable and highly incriminating piece of evidence, a jury can find, consistent with all the other evidence in the case, that they had talked about this ahead of time and that they had decided that this was the story that they were going to try to present to any disinterested witnesses and to the police in order to deflect suspicion from him and to allow them to continue the scheme so that they would obtain the money from the trusts. So that's the evidence that shows that Jody is in the conspiracy. And it is also true that about this...
It certainly shows that the jury could legitimately infer from that she, Jody Poole, was hoping to get her husband out of jail for the murder of his mother. But now, how does that hook her up with the other part of the conspiracy to defraud the estate?
Because at about the same time in November that she is going to Rachel Atkinson to come up with the story that she is to tell the investigators, this is at the time that the Pools have gone to the estate and they're starting to receive money. She's a beneficiary of some of the money at the time. So the time period in this case is she's telling a witness, tell the police something that is false about a highly incriminating piece of evidence. And oh, by the way, at this particular time, Tim has gone to the trustee, and from approximately August of 2006 until sometime in 2008, the trustee had paid out money to both the Pools for some of their joint expenses, including mortgage accounts. Jody knew, for example, that they were in deep financial trouble. And when they started, the money kept coming in. Jody knows that this money is coming in because it's going to help her.
The defendant conceded that she was involved this morning, I think, on two occasions, that she was involved in the efforts to obtain money from the estate.
Right, but our theory here is that this, in other words, because she was taking the money, the jury could infer that this was part of the purpose. In other words, if she's going to benefit financially from this fraud scheme, and she's making false statements to witnesses, the jury can infer that the reason she's going to Rachel Atkinson and asking her to make a false statement is not simply to protect her husband, which would be the way of looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to Poole, but in the light most favorable to the government. The evidence is she was doing this because she was now involved in the conspiracy. Now, as far as conspiratorial purposes, a member doesn't have to know every single detail of a conspiracy. He doesn't have to do all of the work in it by himself. But in this particular case, when you look at all of the evidence in the case, it establishes that she was part of the conspiracy.
She was your witness in her grand immunity. You had her on the stand for a long time. Why didn't you ask her that?
She didn't give the government very much, Judge Agee. She backed off. If you read her testimony in full, she gave the government very little. That is the reason. I mean, she was very cagey about what she told Rachel Atkinson, which is why when you want to find out exactly what she told Rachel Atkinson, you've got to read Rachel Atkinson's testimony, not Jody Poole's testimony. She gave the bare minimum in order to get her deal. Her statement as to why did you provide the false alibi? Well, my husband is a very controlling person, but she must have understood right away, why is my husband coming in the day of a murder asking me to give a false alibi? What does he want me to do? And am I going to help him? Of course. If you look at this, she was involved with it. She may have tried to portray herself as simply an unwitting tool of her husband, but the jury, who actually looked at her, could have come up with a much different perception of her conduct. But I said, go ahead and read her direct testimony when she's asked about what she told Atkinson and Agent Follin. She gave the government the bare minimum.
Well, does that mean that you were, whoever tried the case, was afraid to ask her on the stand, well, did you do all this because you were helping your husband get money from the estate?
Well, I can't speak, for example, why that question wasn't asked, but when you take two pieces of evidence that show that at the same time that she is asking a witness to obstruct justice by making false statements about a highly incriminating piece of evidence, and at that very same time she is also taking money from the estate, a jury could infer that those two things are causally connected, that they just happened by happenstance. So there was certainly sufficient evidence to put her in the conspiracy, even if she didn't do a whole lot of things quantitatively. Qualitatively, asking a witness to obstruct justice, to hide a key piece of evidence, to help her husband, when her husband is telling the same story to witnesses, the dogs ate shoes, the jury can find they're working together. And when she starts is a beneficiary of the Poole estate, they could find she's in that conspiracy, even if that was the extent of her role in that conspiracy. With respect to the 404B evidence that appellant has raised, defendant objected only to the sexual misconduct evidence, as everything else, including the marital privilege evidence, is reviewed only for plain error. With respect to the Mia Evans incident, so there were two incidents in which she spoke relatively briefly about some evidence of sexual misconduct. They had a three-way at one point, and one incident in which they had sex when Tim's wife was in another room. First of all, sex was highly important in this case. The reason that Linda cut off Tim financially, was threatening to, was because of the affair that Mia had with Tim. That was a precipitating fact that led to his decision to kill her. The second thing is, Mia Evans was a government witness, and so it was important, it was important for the government to lay out her complete relationship with Timothy to avoid any charge later that she was hiding something, she was concealing things. So it was important for them to say exactly to say everything that goes on. Now, again, some of this may have been a little disgusting to the jury, but there's a case from this court called Savage, in which also there was some evidence of some disgusting sexual practices, but the court said, you know, heterosexual misconduct isn't the sort of evidence these days that's likely to be provoking a rational response in a juror. And so we submit that the evidence was probative, it was not unduly prejudicial, and the district court on its own initiative gave a limiting instruction telling the jury only to consider this for its proper purposes. And this court had said in Arimony and other cases involving sexual misconduct evidence, we presume that the jury followed the instructions and did not consider them for improper purposes. And when you consider the evidence, which was really a couple of pages of transcript in the whole trial, which lasted 10 days, we submit that this evidence certainly wasn't prejudicial in any event. Judge Agee, you had mentioned the question earlier about the marital privilege evidence and how that relates to the sufficiency of the conspiracy. I want to mention something. In order to get the crime, joint crime exception to the marital privilege, that is to get the evidence of that into evidence, the standard of evidence is not the same thing as beyond a reasonable doubt. In other words, it wouldn't matter whether ultimately you would decide there wasn't sufficient evidence on the conspiracy count. The judge only had to make a preliminary finding here that there was enough evidence to warrant the inference that Jody and Tim were involved in a joint crime, and therefore the marital privilege didn't apply. And in any event, Poole did not object to the marital communications evidence came in. So you would only review that for plain error. There's certainly nothing here that's plain or even anything that would meet the third and fourth prongs of the plain error doctrine. Appellant hasn't argued here the sufficiency of the evidence with respect to Poole's role in the murders. Would you like me to argue that? I mean, that was sort of the whole purpose of the brief. Do you have any questions about that? Because I would like to go, unless you affirmatively stop me, I would like to go through a bit of the evidence here to show why Poole was the person who murdered his parents.
Mr. Booth, you are in control of your argument, but I think you can assume that we are not so shy that if we have a question, we won't ask it.
Well, I would like to go through it anyway, because actually I think that is probably the crux of this case. And beyond a reasonable doubt, the evidence did establish Poole as the murderer of his mother, Linda, and her husband, Henry Hilton. He clearly had the motive. His mother had been supporting him for years, but once she found out that he was having an affair with Mia Evans, she was threatening to cut him off. He was in desperate financial straits. His home was about to be foreclosed on. He was having problems with his girlfriends. There are two particular pieces of evidence at the crime scene that are linked to him. One, the murderer had a pair of 471 New Balance shoes, and the bullets that killed the Pools could have come either from a .38 pistol or from a .357 Magnum. We know that Poole had New Balance 471 shoes and a .38 pistol. We know that because, one, Mia Evans said she purchased a set of the New Balance 471 shoes for him. She also said that Poole always kept a revolver in the console of her car because whenever they went out, she used to see it. Question is, how do we know that that's a .38 pistol? Because the government showed Mia Evans GX-142, which is a picture of a .38 Smith & Wesson, said, does this resemble the gun you saw in the car? And she says, just like it. And what happens, both of these particular items, just conveniently disappear from Poole's household right after the murder. And not only that, at the very beginning, even before Poole is actually accused of a crime, as he is being driven to the crime scene by a trooper, what does he tell them? He volunteers to the trooper, "I gave the .38 pistol to my mother." Now, we know that that's a lie because Mia Evans had seen the .38 pistol in his car. The police never recovered a .38 pistol at the house, and witnesses testified that Linda also used a long gun. And with respect to the New Balance shoes, we have conflicting stories as to what happened to them. We also have a lot of misleading conduct and lies that occur by Poole right after the murders. When he goes to the police, he tells the police that he's having good relations with Linda. Linda's been giving him money. He tells his wife to give him a false alibi. He tells different people conflicting stories of what happened to the .38 revolver and also to the shoes. A couple of other things I would like to point out just to tie him into the murder. Just before the murders, he's been out going to the Poole household several times looking it over. His mother is concerned why she's doing that. The jury could have found that he was casing the place to find the exact time to commit the murder. His cell phone just happened to be off on the day of the murder. That way, so no, his cell phone provider couldn't find out in any incoming calls would ping off the cell phone tower. Another curious example is that the door, that the lock to the gate was locked outside the gate when one of the employees from the Poole household came afterwards. Poole would said in his pretrial statement that he had a key to the gate and he would lock it. Now you have to understand why this is important. It's because when Linda Poole came back, it was their testimony that they normally closed the gate and locked it on the inside. If somebody other than Poole had been the murderer, would he have been able to drive his car out, seen the locked gate, gone back and found a key somewhere, unlocked the lock, gone back outside, locked it again? He would have just gone barreling straight through the gate. The reason it was locked from the outside was because Tim Poole was there. He was the one who did the murders. He was the one who encountered the locked door and the locked gate. And what he went afterwards, he simply locked it again because it was habit of doing that. With respect to that's all my evidence with respect to the sufficiency evidence, and we submit that shows beyond a doubt that Poole was the killer of his parents. With respect to the sentencing issues, I only have a few minutes left. I would like to call your attention to the Thompson case, which I've cited in my brief, which has almost the same set of facts and the same legal issues that are presented here, namely an individual who kills his mother for the insurance money, who's charged with multiple counts of mail fraud. The district court at sentencing makes a finding beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed premeditated murder, and therefore what he does is he uses the cross-reference 2X1.1 to get the defendant a life sentence. He then stacks the mail fraud counts under 5G1.2 to come up with a guideline sentence that's about life imprisonment, and then he sentences the defendant to approximately 190 years, which is longer than his life expectancy. Those are the same issues that Poole has raised in his brief. Judge Williams for the Seventh Circuit made a comprehensive review of all of those issues, and in the balance of time, I will just commend you to that decision. We've incorporated the reasoning on all those issues in our brief. And unless you have any further questions in this case, I would ask this court to affirm the judgment.
Thank you very much. Mr. Milling?
To briefly respond to the presentation of the government, the arguments that they made. If we look at the conduct of Jody Poole subsequent to the murders, and we look at the other controlling nature that the government elicited through some of the improperly admitted evidence, it is clear that Jody Poole was somebody who Tim Poole had under his thumb. He was extremely controlling to the point that he was able to convince her to engage in a three-way with another woman in their marital home. He was able to convince her that he was going to a job working at a Honda plant. He was able to convince her to do a lot of things that she just never questioned.
How does that help you?
Your Honor, I would submit that it helps me because she was the type of an individual that would do things without knowledge that, that what she was doing it was wrong, that, that in this particular case regarding her efforts to obtain the money on her husband's behalf, that she was not doing so because she had a reason to believe that he was involved in the murder of his mother, but rather because he asked her to.
But that is something that a jury could have... The question here is, what could the jury have inferred from what was presented?
Yes, ma'am. Well, and I would submit that they came to the conclusion that they did because of all of the improperly admitted evidence. And if you excise that evidence out, the evidence which should not have been admitted, we've got a completely different characterization of the evidence in this case, a completely different characterization of Tim Poole. And the jury has to look at the evidence which was presented in a different light. As Mr. Booth has pointed out...
And I'm sorry, that would be your argument with respect to plain error?
Yes, ma'am. And looking at the evidence which was found at the scene, the .38 caliber pistol, the New Balance shoe imprint, the testimony at the trial was that this particular shoe imprint was also consistent with 21 other models of New Balance shoes, that the size didn't have to be a size 12 shoe, which was what Mia Evans testified to, but rather it could have been other sizes, half size here, half size there. And so that evidence does not just point to Tim Poole, as the government suggests. Likewise, with the .38 caliber, Tim's suggestion that he had left the firearm with his mother after his father's death, if the perpetrator had used that firearm in the commission of the crime and taken it, of course law enforcement is not going to find it. And the suggestion that because she had other firearms there, she wouldn't have had a need for a .38 caliber firearm. The testimony was that there were a lot of hunts out at the plantation, and that's why she needed the long arms. A .38 caliber pistol is going to be something used for a different purpose. And so that's why she would have had the need for that. There were conflicting stories following the murders regarding whether or not the shoes were chewed up by the dogs or whether or not they had gasoline spilled on them. But ultimately, the evidence was that, based upon the testimony that Tim or that Mia Evans provided, was that Tim said that both of them happened, that the initial brief conversation that he indicated that gasoline was spilled on him was while he was in custody, a very limited meeting setting. And so, Your Honor, I would submit that looking at the evidence in its entirety, looking at the scant evidence which was there at the scene, looking at the reasonable inferences which were drawn from that, those reasonable inferences would have been different had the improperly admitted evidence been excluded during the trial in this case. Your Honor, I would submit that based upon this, the conviction should be vacated and the sentence, and alternatively, the sentence vacated.
Mr. Milling, you are court appointed,
yes,
I believe. Thank you very much for your excellent service to the court this morning. We will, I will ask the, to adjourn court, and we will come down and greet you.